This is Dr. An, and my co-host is Xander Keeg, a licensed social worker. We're both trans guys. And Xander, I'm going to hand this over to you.
Thank you, Dr. An. Well, it's great to have our guest with us today. This is Dr. Jameson Green, who's joining us. I think I met Dr. Jameson Green. I'll just start calling him James from now on. I met James, I think he was either 2006 or 2007. You probably know the year because we met in a meeting of a group of people in the community that were working on a plaque that was going to go into the ground in San Francisco. So I don't remember. It was 2006 or 2007 for sure. And it was commemorating the Compton cafeteria riots that a lot of people have never heard of in 1966 in the Tenderloin district of San Francisco. And we were walking back to BART together, and not one to be shy, so I asked James if he would be my mentor, because I started my testosterone transition phase in 2005, and I had figured out that it'd be really important to have mentors. So that's how we first came to know each other, was by me and my moxie asking, and you said yes, and we've been connected ever since. So it's been a really wonderful experience for me. Also, I read Jameson's book, Becoming a Visible Man, the first version. He'll talk a little bit more about his books, but that's where I was introduced to just a whole world that I was completely unfamiliar with. And so I'm just really thankful for you to be my mentor, my friend, to be in my life, to have contributed so much to the trans community. And so it's just an honor and privilege to have you with us today, Dr. Green, James.
Thank you, Xander. And thank you, Dr. An. It's a pleasure to be with you both.
We're happy you're here.
So let's jump right in about books. So there's a book that's currently in peer review. It's pending publication. The title is From Margins to Mainstream, A History of Transgender Medicine in the U.S. My understanding is that you are part of the editorial team, and you're also one of several, 50-something or
52.
More authors. Yeah.
52 contributing writers, yeah.
Yeah, so why don't you tell us a little bit about how that book came to be and what the process has been like, or what are some of the, don't spoil it for people, but if there's anything you can reveal to us about the theme of the book other than trans medicine in the U.S., but like, what does that mean?
Sure. And trans medicine could be kind of dry as a topic, and we didn't want it to be dry. The book was conceived by a cisgender woman physician in upstate New York, Dr. Carolyn Wolf Gould, who runs a well-respected transgender medicine clinic it's a rural clinic in upstate New York. And she came up with the idea for this book. What happened was she wrote a paper with the same title, actually just From Margins to Mainstream, and talking about creating her clinic. And it was published, I don't know where, but in a journal, an academic journal, or a professional journal, probably a professional journal, frankly, because her clinic was funded by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is a major contributor to the medical field. Anyway, she used that title, From Margins to Mainstream, and I think she may have been talking with people at SUNY, and someone from, and she may have done a presentation at SUNY. They have a gender-related conference that happens, and I think this is the story. Anyway, she'll let us know at some point if I'm wrong, but I don't think she'll disapprove of this story, even if it's not 100% correct. Basically, that one of the editors from SUNY Press approached her and suggested turning this whole business into a book. And she recruited a young trans man physician who was also from the upstate New York area, although he's in an urban environment, well, as urban as upstate New York gets, and he works in a hospital, and he's incredibly bright. His name is Kyan Lynch, and he was her second recruit, and then they decided, and he's a trans man, so they decided they needed some more trans editors, and they reached out and recruited Dallas Denny, and who's a well-known trans activist from the South. She's now located in New Jersey, but she was well-known. She was originally from Tennessee, and she was well-known in the 90s for starting the American Educational Gender Information Service, or AEGIS, and had a massive collection of books and articles documenting transgender history. such as it was, and especially theories about medicine. She was in the medical field as a licensed psychological examiner for the state of Georgia, and that was her career. She also, on the side, edited the Transgender Tapestry magazine from that was published by International Foundation for Gender Education for many years. And she also produced a magazine called Chrysalis, which was Aegis, her organization's magazine, and then various newsletters over the years as well. So she was very well connected and very knowledgeable. And she and I had collaborated on several articles for books over the years, and I'd written some stuff for her for Tapestry and also for Chrysalis. But they recruited her, and then they decided they needed one more. And Dallas suggested they recruit me. And they basically, by that time, they had been working on it for over 2 years. They had put out a call for contributors, and I had responded to that because I wanted to put out their table of contents, their proposed table of contents, and what articles they wanted to have. And they were looking for authors who would commit to writing certain chapters on certain topics. So it wasn't that you would write your version of whatever. It was that you would do some research and you would write the story of this, whatever it was. And I wanted to write the story of the insurance, the issue of health insurance in the United States, because I'd done a tremendous amount of activism in that area. But they accepted my proposal for that. And so I was signed up to do that. I was busy, however, with other things and didn't get around to it for a long time. At least 2 years went by, and then they recruited me as their fourth editor. And by that time, I was really excited to be working on that project. I didn't have any more super pressing WPATH related duties. I was the president of WPATH. I was elected in 2011 and served as president from 2014 through summer of 2016. And then I was continued on the executive committee until the end of 2018. So I was very, very much involved with the administration of WPATH for that entire time and didn't have a lot of time for writing. But when I came in, they were sort of in the doldrums, as you say, in the seafaring world. They were in the doldrums, and they were kind of in a lull, and there were authors that they had contracted with who were not producing, and they were constantly chasing after them to get their thing done. And they had one really famous author who was committed to doing a chapter on Magnus Hirschfeld, who's not in the United States, but was very crucial to the development of this field and had much contact with Harry Benjamin, who was crucial to development of this field in the United States. So that was a major connection there. And this author sort of disappeared, and turned out he'd gone to South Korea and he was really busy with other things. So, but we didn't find that out for years. So this is how books go, especially when the collaborative books with the large number of authors can be very, very frustrating. So anyway, I got really excited about this and interjected a bunch of energy into the project. And it took another 3 years to get it all put together, my energy notwithstanding. I think one of the last chapters to be completed was my chapter on the associations, WPATH, well, HBIGDA, Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association, which evolved into WPATH, which is the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, and the Endocrine Society and standards of care, the issues around all that. So I was doing that chapter. And as it happened, the insurance chapter turned out to be a 2,000-word sidebar in the associations chapter, or maybe it was in the, yeah, I think it was in the associations chapter. Anyway, there's so much to say. Not only that, but SUNY Press gave us a contract for a book with a maximum page count of 500 manuscript pages, and we turned in over 900 manuscript pages 3 years late. Or actually 2 years, 2 years late. No, 1 year late. Turned it in at the end of 2022. I think it was either 1 or 2 years late. But they're very excited about it, nonetheless, and they've sent it out for peer review. And I have to say, probably 200 pages of those 900 pages are duplicate references. And we made sure that every chapter had its own references, and we didn't consolidate all the references in one bibliography. Yet, that's a production, book production issue that the press will need to solve or help us solve in any case. And so we just wanted to make sure that each chapter had its own discrete reference list. And so, you know, there's probably 100 references to Harry Benjamin's book, for example, in all the different chapters. So there's a lot that needs to be sorted out in that regard. You know, all the details of editorial design, it's a very complicated project. So the 52 writers, some of them have written chapters and some of them have written, there's only actually 22 chapters in the whole book, but a lot of authors contributed what we called in our creation cycle, we called them sidebars. And those are specialized little essays, short essays on a specific aspect of the topic relevant to the chapter that it appears in. And so, for instance, we have a number of sidebars that have to do with Christine Jorgensen. And we have a lot of fascinating information about people in the 40s and 50s who knew they were trans. Christine Jorgensen hadn't happened yet, but were looking for information about themselves. They recognized there was a difference between them and other people. And they looked for doctors who could help them understand this. And it isn't that doctors went out and discovered the freaky, weird trans people. Trans people went looking for doctors who would help them understand themselves and would help them manage their lives. And that's how this field developed, frankly.
That's a really interesting distinction between going out and looking for us versus us going and looking for the providers.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to talk a little bit more about some of the experiences and history of trans people within, at least within the United States, medically speaking. Before we do that, I'd love for you to tell us a little bit more about some of the other writing projects, some of the other articles you've written, chapters in other books, your book, Becoming a Visible Man. If you want to just tell us a little bit more so that people can look these up, learn more about you.
Wow, I wish I had my CV handy. Because I can't remember the titles of everything that I've written or where they are.
You talk to us about Becoming a Visible Man.
Yeah, that I am very intimate with. So Becoming a Visible Man started as a collection of essays and became, some call it a memoir, but it's much more than a memoir. Although I do use my personal experience as a sort of emotional hook for the reader as they proceed through recognizing what transgender is, understanding what options are available, dealing with the issues of relationships and our relationship as a community, relationship to society. So, and some of the history of trans men's community development, because that's trans men's stuff is, talk about marginalized, is super marginalized, really, really quite invisible. So that's why I called it Becoming a Visible Man. It's sort of a double entendre. On one hand, it's about the visibility of trans community at all and the bond between trans men and trans women for in the movement for health and rights is crucial. And our bond to the lesbian, gay, bisexual community is also important from a political standpoint, but from a real nitty-gritty social standpoint, not quite so much. And there's been a lot of conflict between trans community and gay, lesbian, bi community. Bi people are more accepting of trans people than most gay and lesbian people, but on the whole, we've come a long way with respect to that understanding and the political necessity of that those connections, because we're all faced with this exact same oppression and the exact same prejudices and the exact same punishment, if you will, from society, regardless of who we are, because they don't understand us. They think we're all the same, and we're not. But that doesn't mean any of us deserve to be mistreated socially as we are. All right, enough of that. So books. So anyway, Becoming a Visible Man started out, that's the double entendre, is the visibility of the trans community and learning how to be a man because I'm not perceived as female anymore. Not that I was 100% perceived as female prior to my transition. I certainly was not. And that was one of the struggles. And yet I had learned a lot of coping mechanisms because of my difference while I was in a female body I had many coping mechanisms that when people couldn't tell what sex I was and they would challenge me. And I had to unlearn those coping mechanisms once I became a visible man, because those kind of coping mechanisms can get you in a lot of trouble.
That's really interesting. You know, I was just talking with a parent recently about their teenage trans son who had an experience going into a men's bathroom at work and having, I've never heard of it going this way. I remember my experience going into women's bathrooms before I transitioned, and they do the like step out, look at the door, look at you, am I in the right place? And this parent was telling me, this father was telling me that the son had that experience in the men's room. And I thought, well, I've never heard of that, where a man is like, step back, look at the door, look at the, you know. And
I've seen it.
Yeah.
I saw it either not when I was in early transition, but pre-transition, pre-actual transition, because there were some circumstances where it was safer for me to use a men's room, and or it was convenient. And lots of, and like, you know, we always hear about it in football stadiums, baseball stadiums, the women are using the men's room because the line in the women's room is too long because the women's rooms are too small. So anyway, it happened to me. So I've seen it before.
I like about having coping mechanisms, though, like, because he was asking how can they learn to deal with that?
Well, my response to that would be, got a problem? What's the matter? You lost? You know,
yeah.
Make a joke out of it.
Yeah, I shared that there's a lot of different ways that we respond, and some can be comical and some can be crude and some can be a bit outrageous, that everybody sort of falls into whatever is their natural, you know, tendency, or is how to react and respond in that moment.
Did he feel safe? Did he express that at all?
Yeah, he didn't express anything about safety. He was at work. I believe it was just another coworker, but maybe like a newer coworker who wasn't understanding what was going on. This is a person who's not on hormones, so
If the coworker understands them to be female, then of course they would see that. It's not like they're a stranger, so that is a different kind of a situation. And
you'd think that like that's respectful, because you don't want him coming into the wrong bathroom,
right?
This other person, it's like, he's like, oh, I don't want to go in the wrong bathroom.
Right.
So it's like, how does the young person, how does the trans person interpret that? Oh, I'm not being seen as the man I am, or, oh, that man is trying to be respectful. And just on first glance, he made an assumption. He's incorrect, but he's making an assumption based on a visualization, right? It's like how to navigate through that.
So the other aspect of that for in this particular case is this young trans guy using the bathroom before he's being physically recognizable as a man could be a problem. And so he might want to hold off if he's planning to start testosterone. He might want to wait a little while before he starts making use of the men's room on a frequent basis, so that he's more visibly male.
Is this in Florida?
No, it was not in Florida. It was, I don't remember the state now. It wasn't in Florida. It was at a restaurant. The person works in a restaurant.
I would have to agree with Jameson.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a bit of a thorny topic,
right?
Because there are people within the community, within our community, the trans community, who want to be able to use a bathroom based on self-identification. And in some states, that is the law. It's based on self-identification. It's not based on any medical treatment. It's not based on any particular physical presence that we have, our appearance. This is where there's a lot of contention, and why there's laws that are being proposed, and in some places passing and then going through the court systems to get them out again, right? Because this is a topic area where it's like, if the idea is, well, until you're seen in some majority of the time as the sex that you're entering the bathroom of, like when we go into these binary bathroom options, that makes perfect sense to me. It made perfect sense to On. Some people might take issue with it in our community.
Yeah, right? Because ostensibly the premise is no one should be forced to take any kind of medical treatment, to have any kind of surgery in order to actualize their gender identity. I wrote a statement like that for WPATH, saying that this is WPATH's position, and that because many people will never be able to afford any medical treatment, even if they want it, and that shouldn't mean that everybody has to deny their gender identity.
And yet that doesn't also preclude us from having run-ins when we're in public places.
That's right.
So we have to sort out how to navigate through those to the best of our ability, staying as safe as possible, and also not taking on so much that it destroys us emotionally, mentally, socially. Yeah, it's a
It's a
it, it,
tightrope.
we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
You had talked a little bit about, talk about trans medicine, and you mentioned some historical figures within, the context of trans medicine. And I'm wondering for our listeners, we have listeners that are primarily in the US, the UK, and India, right? All over the world, but those are the three largest communities of listeners. And I'm wondering, what would you like to share with the listeners that is something that is maybe not as well known or not as well understood, just about trans people, our experience, our history? Like, what are some things that you would like to be able to convey to people for that they might go on and do some of their own further, research, investigation, musings?
Well, one thing that I think has been notable in many of the historical medical journal articles about trans people, and something that trans people themselves figure out, is that, first of all, this is a naturally occurring condition. It's not a social contagion. Virtually, historically, every trans person has gone through this in isolation prior to the advent of the internet. And we all manage to figure out that we're different, and we manage to figure out some kind of coping mechanism. And that has been true historically. In many societies, in the ancient societies, that there have been social spaces for trans people. And they're not everyone. I mean, sometimes people think, oh, all the Native American tribes were totally cool with trans people who call themselves Two-Spirit, blah, blah, blah. No, that's not true. Not all Native tribes, not all indigenous populations accepted gender variance. But gender variance is something that naturally occurs in humanity throughout the world, in every class, every culture, every race. It's not anything that isn't naturally human. It's what we do with it that impacts how we can succeed or thrive and how we have moved forward. And with the oppression that went on in the 1800s and the anti-sexuality that was going on in the 1800s and the Enlightenment sort of scientific desire for classifying things, that was one of the crucial turning points historically in galvanizing a transgender community and seeking out medical support. So some medical people looked at us and thought, well, they might see one of us in their career and they'd say, this is a really weird person. This person is really twisted and has something horribly wrong with them. And then when they started doing like Freud and this early psychiatrist started analyzing people's dreams and, all this kind of, stuff. I mean, this is really early in terms of accessing in building the field of mental health. They started realizing that a lot more people than they imagined had these pictures of themselves as members of the opposite sex, and that they really wanted to live that way. And they really felt they belonged in that other space. But society was so oppressive that there was no way that they could. And yet there were people who did. There were individuals throughout history who successfully cross-lived, if you will, as a term, and were not discovered until after their death that they were actually the sex opposite that which people thought they were.
This is before the advent of the synthesizing of hormones, where you could
Exactly.
actually take the medicines.
Exactly. And in the 1940s, well, I think hormones began to be synthesized in the 20s, but we really didn't know
We as a society really didn't know very much about them until in the 40s. And then we actually had some trans people get hold of them and start experimenting. And one of the earliest ones was Michael Dillon in England. He was a medical student. He learned about hormones. He managed to prescribe them for himself. He started taking testosterone. He wrote a lot about hormones and the effect and how they can support your actual gender. And later, like in the 80s, therapists who were treating men who cross-dressed. So these were people with masculine gender identities who cross-dressed, and they were feeling, well, society hates me because I cross-dress, but I really feel compelled to do this. And then they start to gain a little more confidence, and I really like being cross-dressed. Maybe I'm a transsexual. And so therapists would say, all right, well, let's get a prescription for you, and you can take some estrogen and see how that makes you feel. And 99% of the time, cross-dressers who would take estrogen would go, oh no. They'd take the estrogen. It did not make them feel good. It did not have effects that supported their gender identity. And they said, no, forget that. No, I'm not a transsexual. There's no way I can live on this hormone. And people talk about roid rage, conversely, for people who take testosterone. And, you know, there's always been this idea that toxic masculinity was fed by testosterone. And a lot of times, trans people who were born in female bodies, who were angry and super butch and would get in fights and things like that, they start taking testosterone, and that immediately goes away. Because,
well, you just described my experience.
See, there you go. You're not the only one I've known who's had that experience. And so, and I think that actually the thing that makes men crazy, although, well, let me say this. First of all, we discovered testosterone taken to excess does not make you super masculine. It just, whatever your body can't use. If you have a female body to start with, and you take too much testosterone, whatever you can't use is just wasted because it's converted to estrogen. If you have a masculine body, if you have a male body to start with, and you take a lot of testosterone, as many athletes have done, if they overdose on testosterone, they begin to grow breasts. So essentially, it's converting into estrogen. It doesn't convert chemically. It's not exactly the same process. It doesn't convert in exactly the same way as it does in a body that was born female. But if you give somebody a lot extra testosterone, or they have naturally a superabundance of testosterone, and they are engaging, say, in criminal behavior, and a lot of times we've sought to treat aggressive men by castrating them, and men who were abusive to women and things, by castrating them and stopping their testosterone production. Well, then you find that not having testosterone in their system destroys their bone density, that estrogen doesn't replace bone density at the same rate that estrogen will. I mean, both sex hormones are important in any human body. All human bodies have both sex hormones, both estrogen and testosterone, just in different amounts. If you give somebody a lot of testosterone and then take it away and you replace it with estrogen, their mood swings are horrific, absolutely horrific. And I think that men who have high levels of testosterone probably also have high levels of estrogen. And if they have mood swings, it's because of the hormones fighting with each other.
Not it's like the hormone swings can lead to the mood swings.
Yes.
The physician who was treating women for menopause, so he put them on estrogen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then they were complaining that their symptoms were worsening. So then he discovered the magic potion, I should say, and he introduced progesterone.
Mm-hmm.
Got back on the estrogen. And then it was a win-win. But I'm right with you. I think that probably is a strong case you point out with men who are aggressive. Large amounts of T convert to E. And if they're already shooting off high levels, I wouldn't doubt if that wouldn't be balanced out with the estrogen. But
Right.
that fighting piece, and that's so interesting. I had to get away from testosterone and go on to nandrolone because that's what was happening with me. I just kept saying, I think it's converting. And I was right, because when I went on nandrolone, I was able to maintain a balance.
Interesting. Yeah, there's a lot we don't know still. There's a lot that has not been sufficiently studied. But the fact remains, my original point was that hormones don't make you something that you aren't. Hormones basically accentuate what you already have. They can't give you features or qualities that you don't already possess.
Yeah, we interviewed Dr. Erica Anderson recently, and she was telling us how it hasn't happened a lot of times, but she says it has happened that younger clients of hers have asked her, how long do I need to be on the testosterone before I start producing semen?
Right. People are very ignorant about how bodies work. It's really pathetic how little we're actually taught or exposed to about how our bodies actually work. This is very common.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that a lot of guys want when they have genital reconstruction is they want to be able to ejaculate. They may know that they're not going to have semen that will impregnate a woman, but they still think they can ejaculate.
Yeah. I really appreciate us being able to talk about these topics, because there's not really a lot of opportunities to talk about these things. And I especially appreciate, because On is a nurse. So that medical expertise is always really helpful, and the ability for you to apply that on in your own specific, in your own journey with medications, to be able to figure that out. Because this medication that you're taking, I had never even heard of it. I still didn't even know what it is, right? It's not something that I hear people talking about. It's
right.
Either anethinate or cypionate and testosterone, right? That's it. That's all we ever hear about.
In the United States and in the UK, they have Sustanon. In Australia, also Sustanon, which I'm allergic to because that's in peanut oil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ours are sesame and cottonseed oil. There's also,
right.
I've met gentlemen who have had the pellets under the skin, right? Into the subcutaneous levels. And there's under the tongue, sublingual testosterone. There are a bunch of different options. But this idea of learning about like how it converts into estrogen, and how these are things that perhaps not everybody is getting information about.
Well, these are the kinds of things that I talk about in my book, is learning all this stuff. And, it's stories. It's connected to trying to figure things out for myself. And, you know, back to the book thing, if you don't mind,
please,
if you'll forgive me. So in 2019, I got a phone call from my publisher, which is Vanderbilt University Press. And they said, you know, we've had some turnover here. We have a new director. We have a new acquisitions editor. We have new production people. We've been going through the old records and stuff, and we realize your book is the best-selling book on our list of all time. And we'd like to, next year, 2020, they said, is our 80th anniversary year. And we'd like to give your book a new treatment. We thought, you know, a new cover and some more promotion, and maybe you'd write a preface for it. And I said, could I update the text? Because a lot has happened since 2004, when the first edition was published. And I'd really, really like to be able to update the text. And they said, okay, yeah, we need to keep it close to the same page count. So you need to try to work that out. But which was a little bit of a challenge. But I think I did a pretty decent job updating all the vocabulary, updating the scientific references, adding a lot of the political, you know, just updates that have happened, and some of the work that I've done, and all my work with WPATH. I didn't start working with Habigda and WPATH until right after the first edition was submitted. I was elected to the board in 2003, and that was the year I turned the manuscript in. I'd already been attending their meetings and stuff, but I wasn't on the board or anything. But so 2003, I turned the manuscript in. 2004, the book comes out. It's already out of date. So so I did a revised edition. It came out in September of 2020, second edition. And it's also available on audiobook on Audible. And that came out in 2022.
Well, congratulations. I mean, what an honor to receive that call, to hear that news. I mean, that's just phenomenal. And that they gave you that opportunity to update. You're right. As soon as it was published originally, it was out of date already, because our community is dynamic and so much changes so quickly that we none of us can really keep up. Right.
Right. And so, you know, and this is the same with the history book. We discovered so many things in our research and have told things in very personal ways with as much energy as possible, not to be a dry history book. And there are things in there that are surprising. And yet we had a 500 page limit and we turned in over 900 pages and I couldn't write the chapter on insurance. And it's just a summary. So in so many ways, we just have keep summarizing and leaving things open. And we have what I'm hoping that this book, From Margins to Mainstream, will do. First of all, that it will awaken people to the dynamics, as you say, of the community and of the stories that exist in our community and the history that we are building every day, but also awaken young scholars and researchers to the inspiration of looking deeper into almost any aspect of this history. There's so much we couldn't possibly say, so much we couldn't possibly put in these pages. So it's an overview, if you will, and a tribute to the tenacity and the resilience of transgender people. And I hope that it will be inspirational for scholars and students and professionals and anyone who wants to read it. The general audience is probably undergraduate studies in the variety of fields, history, sociology, medicine could look at it. It's not technical in medicine, but it's sort of like medical anthropology in a way. But there's a lot in it that I think will surprise people.
I like what you just said, medical anthropology, and I think we need more of that.
And we especially need it in the trans field. I recently wrote an article, was published just last fall in the Journal of Law, Medicine, and Ethics. They did a special issue, which is open access, so it's free to anyone, that's all on transgender health. And most of the articles are research-based and a variety of voices, mostly trans voices. I think they are all trans voices. And very, very thoughtful, thought-provoking. And then they asked me to write a personal essay on my experience working with WPATH. And I think it's a pretty informative piece that will kind of surprise people about how do we make change is really what it's about. It's called Unbending the Light, Changing Laws and Policies to Make Transgender Health Visible.
We're going to take another commercial break. Even if we accept the possibility of some 73 different genders or more, the simple male or female alternatives provide an abundance of health issues that justify our care and attention. From cradle to grave, fertility to menopause, from the universal desire to make a positive difference to individuals, personal desires not to disappear without trace. Mental health once was a taboo topic. This vital area is now getting the attention it deserves. We are all products of our background. The challenge is how we avoid becoming victims of our history. You've been listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Keeg.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
We're back from our second break. We're talking with Dr. Jameson Green about one of his books titled Bending the Light.
That's a beautiful title.
An advocate's perspective or something like that. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. If it's your history of your experience with WPATH, I would imagine there's some pros and cons in there, right?
Yeah, well, and I had a word limit too, so it's not super detailed, I have to say, I have to explain how I got to be with WPATH too, since I'm not a clinician. You know, it's a professional organization that their members are primarily clinicians and then some lawyers, not so many, but anymore. But there was a period where we had quite a few legal scholars as members, clinicians and researchers who do clinical research, clinically based research. I was told in the beginning that I couldn't be a full member because I wasn't in those categories. It's all in the story. But how did I get there? Why did I, as your average trans person who wanted to be a writer, who worked in high tech, why would I find myself leading a medical association? And well, that's explained in the article. And it's not terribly long. So it's not an autobiography again, right? Neither is Becoming a Visible Man. Nothing, there's no autobiography has been written or biography, but.
Well, and thank goodness you did, because you were able to champion a lot of changes.
Well, more changes. I made more changes during my presidency than had occurred within that organization since its inception over the whole 37 years that it existed before my presidency. And I made more changes than ever before. I mean, all in a period of 2.5 years.
We're coming upon the hour, and I would love to have you back, don't you think, Xander, to talk about the insurance industry?
Absolutely. Anything else? I mean, it's just, there's so much information here that is not known to most people, even within our own community. There's right. A lot of information historically, medically, socially. There's a lot of information here. And you've mentioned coping mechanisms a number of times throughout the course of this. And so I dial in on that because that's my job. That's what I do as a social care worker in the social work field. And one of the things I'm thinking about is the resiliency that is demonstrated in the stories of our history when there was no access to things like the internet, and now there's a proliferation of information on all kinds of media platforms, but the coping mechanisms, the coping skills are not so good right now, right?
Information is not always thoughtful. Information is not always valuable. Information is not always applicable. There's so much information now. We're inundated with information. How do we find what's useful to us? How do we find what really matters? How do we find what's true?
That is the most beautiful way to end this.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you so much, James, for being here.
It's been wonderful, and I'm glad I had a chance to meet you.
Thank you, An. I'm glad I had a chance to meet you, too.
You were listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. An and Xander Keag. Tune in next time. Our guest will be James Beeman. We hope you will join us. The Umbrella Hour covers transgender care and the gender diverse population.